Subscribe to Simply Bitcoin.
All right, everybody, welcome in. It's another episode of the Meme Factory podcast. This is test stream number 26, because there's never going to be a real stream. They can't shut us down if we're just testing. This evening, we are graced by none other than Lynn Alden. Lynn, how are you doing this evening?
Pretty good. Well, you know, I'm fortunate not to be in some of the areas that are not having a good day, but, you know, it's okay on my end here.
Fair enough. Now, for anybody who hasn't seen any of your content before, could you go ahead and tell us who you are and what it is that has the Bitcoin space interested in you?
Sure. I run LynnAlden.com, where I provide essentially, you know, investment research, macro analysis, that type of thing. My background is electrical engineering. And so I worked as an engineer. Then I went to engineering management, kind of contract financial management, and then shifted more into investing, which is something I've been doing, you know, for a long time. And I started covering Bitcoin back in 2017, but I really ramped it up in 2020, because that's when I got more bullish on it. You know, people in the space know me for their long form research that I put out, as well as appearing on podcasts.
You know, I've seen you a few times on one of our rival podcasts. I don't know if you know it. It's called What Bitcoin Did.
I think I've heard of it. One of the smaller ones. Yeah.
He doesn't get as many views as we do, but you know, I would love to bribe you away from him. What can we offer you that will just cement you as a regular Meme Factory guest?
A car or a small garage, perhaps.
Yeah, I don't know. That's pretty hard, especially because we're only in test streams.
Yeah,
right.
We have memes. We do have memes to offer.
That is true.
All right.
That is true.
We'll think of something by the end of this episode. I'll throw some offers at you. We'll see. In the meantime, in order to get enough money to bribe you, we have to have our sponsors happy. Part of that means that we're going to force you to read the ad copy that they send us in order that we can make that money. So
yeah,
you've gotten it. If you could go ahead and have at it, that'd be great.
Yep, time to do the shills. This episode of the Meme Factory podcast is brought to you by the hardworking men and women at the Central Banking Cartel and their newest product, Rate Hikes. Did you go a little too far with quantitative easing? Did you let that inflation run a little too hot into a stagnating economy? Is your country's stock market so strong, even the flushing? Well, we've got a product for you. With this one simple trick, you can just ratchet down that stock market, slow growth, and kill all your zombie corporations. A few swift keystrokes will send your commodities and yield curve into backwardation so fast it'll make your head spin. You can watch as your entire financial system blows out in new and interesting ways, with dollar amounts even Ben Bernanke couldn't stomach. The best part about rate hikes, they're not permanent. As soon as you've inflicted enough pain on your country's populace, you can make cheap... You can make cheap credit again to scoop up all those distressed assets you made with rate hikes in the first place. So don't hesitate. Pick up your phone and reach out to your local cartel branch to see how you can implement rate hikes today.
Hey. We can get paid now.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Speaking of rate hikes, have the events?
Thank you.
Thank you, cartel. Thank you, cartels. have the events of today done anything for your outlook as to whether or not we're going to be getting any, or how fast and how hard they're coming?
You know, around the margins, the market is pricing in, you know, slightly slower, kind of slightly less hawkish Fed. We've also seen remarks out of the ECB about, you know, potentially being more dovish. Even some of Fed officials have kind of hinted at that. I've already been kind of taking the under on how many rate hikes they're going to be able to get in, because the big challenge for them is that, you know, you have the dual mandates, so you have, you know, you're trying to maximize employment and you're trying to do quote unquote stable prices, which they define as 2% annual inflation with the way they measure inflation. And so they're kind of in that awkward position where inflation's over 7.5%. Or a little lower, the way the metric they prefer to use, which is PCE. But either way, it's way above their target. And official unemployment is pretty low, so they have a clear mandate to tighten. And the challenging part is that the economy is already decelerating. usually when they tighten, they raise rates, they do, you know, they end quantitative easing. It's because you have a period of stronger economic growth, and then they try to tighten into that and do some of the work we just talked about in the, you know, for our ad sponsor there. But, you know, right now the challenge is that they're trying to tighten into a decelerating economy. So I already kind of am skeptical about how, you know, they're clearly going to tighten to some degree, but the question is how far they're going to get. And so over the past few months, investment banks have been kind of tripping over each other to give more and more hawkish estimates for how many rate hikes the Fed was going to get. And I think that hit kind of a crescendo where now they're kind of dialing those back a little bit. There was kind of discussion around whether or not they would do 25 basis points or 50 basis points in March, because apparently that's like a big deal these days. Like, you know, inflation's officially 7.5%. And we're like, should we have 0.25% interest rates or 0.5%? You know, and like, this is like, you know, a bunch of people that are, they earn like $1 million will sit around a table and like debate this. And now we're kind of erring more towards probably looking at 25 basis points, which was my base case anyway, but we kind of went closer to that, I think.
What do you think happens? What happens in the macro picture when they raise rates 25 basis points, 50 basis points, and how long, and in what kind of time frame are you talking about the events that happen after the rate hikes?
So I think it's kind of like a sell the news event, usually, the first rate hike, because, you know, what they start telegraphing it ahead of time. They've been telegraphing it for months.
Yeah.
And so what catches the market off guard is when something happens, it's more hawkish than they thought, right? Or the other, you know, if something's more dovish than they thought, they kind of error correct. And so they've already kind of priced in so much hawkishness. That might be why you got some weird action out of the stock market today. I mean, anyone watching the market today,
yeah,
you know, apparently
gold and Bitcoin.
Oh, yeah, that was my favorite action today.
Yeah, you had gold, you know, first was gold up, stocks and Bitcoin down. Then you had gold down, stocks and Bitcoin up. And apparently, like, Roku stock is like the best war hedge, because that's, you know, and it's, but I think part of it is because it's, you know, it's high multiple stocks, so very, very high valuation growth stocks tend to be the most interest rate sensitive, because, you know, so much of their expected cash flows are out into the distant future. So they're more sensitive to these discounted cash flow analysis models that they use. And so when you get a pretty small change in the forward direction of interest rates, they can have these kind of crazy actions. So a lot of people thought, okay, sell everything. And they're like, wait a second, buy all these, like, you know, growth stocks that are down like 80%, because, you know, the Fed might hike less than expected. So I don't think, you know, 25 basis points shouldn't really affect anything. I think it's the signaling about whether or not they're going to go all the way up to like 2 or 3%, which is what some market participants are expecting might happen. Now, the funny thing is, with inflation at 7.5%, even 2 or 3% would still be negative rates. But, you know, if you look at kind of the forward inflation expectations embedded in the TIPS market, for example, which is, you know, we can talk about the accuracy of that, but, you know, they expect inflation to come down and interest rates to go up until you get kind of the semblance of, like, you know, mildly positive real rates, but I don't think that's going to happen. So my base case is I have no specific idea of how high they're going to get with rates. So I think probably they're going to get to a lower level than last cycle by a little bit. But I don't think they're going to be able to do structurally positive real rates anytime, anywhere soon, right? You can, if you look at short-term rates before, like, you know, short-term rates compared to inflation, we spent about a decade at slightly below zero. And the only time they got briefly positive was like 2018, which is when everything kind of started to fall apart. And then they had to back up and you know, pause rate hikes and then eventually dial them back down. And I think we're going to be in a similar situation, except more inflationary. So probably deeper average real yields.
So when you talk
this decade,
when you talk cycles, you're just talking about the previous rate hike cycle. You're not talking about any other particular cycle.
No, yeah, just the rate hike cycle. So if you look at all the previous cycles over the past few decades, they get the lower highs each time. And that's because there's more debt in the system as a percentage of GDP. And so something breaks earlier in the process. You know, they basically tighten until something breaks. And right. Then they have to reverse. And so the question is, are they going to get further than last time or not as far? And there are a bunch of factors that can go into that. You know, if I were to make the case for how they could get further than last time, it could be that inflation's so hot that they get actually higher rates, but they're still deeply negative, right? So that would still be considered easy money. Yeah. So that's one option. The other option is that, you know, they just don't get as far as last time, and they continue to trend of not being able to get, you know, tighter than the previous cycle. And so either way, I think that we're due for, you know, the 2020s. I think, you know, just like we look back in the 2010s, and short-term rates were below inflation for most of the decade, I think it's gonna be the same for the 2020s, with the caveat, you know, with the exception that I think it's actually more extreme. I think most of the yield curve is gonna be below the inflation. So even long duration, I think most of it's gonna spend most of the time below the inflation rate.
And the Fed is still expanding the balance sheet at this time, right? So as they're going into this moment where they're saying that they're gonna raise rates, they're also still expanding the balance sheet. Is that kind of, you know, what does that look like in your mind? Do you think that they'll still expand the balance sheet and still do QE as they raise rates?
Well, as they, according to them, no. And so that would be pretty unprecedented for them to do. They plan to stop it by March and then do the first rate hike. And then they're talking about doing, you know, quantitative tightening. And, you know, they did quantitative tightening last time. They only, you know, they only managed it for, I think it was less than 2 years until the repo market broke. I think we can get to a situation where they end up, you know, right now they're talking about tightening while they're still literally easing. That's kind of unprecedented, right? So this is the furthest they've ever been behind the curve of inflation since at least 1951. And so meaning that, you know, inflation is 7.5% officially, and they're still at zero, and they're, you know, they're talking about maybe doing quantitative tightening while they're literally still doing quantitative easing. It's like they're so concerned about spooking the market, they have to like telegraph months in advance, and it ends up looking really silly because they're really talking about tightening when they're still actively easing. Whereas instead of just saying, okay, the first step is to stop easing, right? But they're still easing. I think what they're going to do is kind of like take liquidity away with one hand and give it back with another hand, because they put in place these standing repo facilities. And what that means is, so for example, if we go back to March 2020, you know, and really the repo crisis, if you go back to September 2019, which is when the repo spike happened. And for people that don't know what that means, banks have this overnight lending rate between each other, and it's normally like just boring financial plumbing stuff. But on one random day in September, it just totally blew out to like 7%, and it should be almost nothing. And that's one of those things where it, like, the Fed responded within like 24 hours, because that's a catastrophe if it just stays like that, right? That's like everything just implodes. And so they went in, they started doing repo activities, meaning, you know, they would, you know, places could essentially deposit their treasuries at the Fed and get cash. So it kind of added liquidity to the market. And what they have now is they have a standing repo facility, meaning that whenever institutions need it, they can take treasuries and deposit at the Fed in exchange for cash temporarily. And so they kind of already have that in place. So you could have a situation where they're trying to tighten, and then you start to get, you know, instability similar to what you saw in 2019, but that they already have the facility in place, and they start doing repo activities while still trying to hold the balance sheet officially flat, even though they're doing increasing repo activities. And so I think they could do kind of shadow QE at some point.
Couldn't they also do shadow QE through entities like BlackRock?
Well, it depends on the mechanism. They use them for their corporate QE that they were doing. That ended up being almost entirely jawboning, because they actually barely bought any corporate bonds. Just the mere threat of buying bonds and then buying a few to prove it made the market do it for them. So a lot of rate setting, and where like a lot of kind of basically the biggest policy tool the Fed has is like jawboning and trying to get the market to do what it does for it. Even back in the 40s, I often refer to that yield curve control period, which is one of the most extreme monetary environments the U.S. ever had.
They called it ham-fisted monetary.
Yeah, ham-fisted. Yeah, they just – so what they did was they had – so inflation got up to 19% year over year during 1 year in the 40s. The average inflation of the decade was like 6%, and I include the really early 50s in that. So basically early 40s to early 50s, and you had 6% average inflation. They held rates at zero almost the entire decade, or near zero. And then they also capped the long end of the curve. So they said, okay, we're going to literally buy as many 10-year treasuries as we need to hold them at 2.5% or less. They basically said, any treasury that goes over 2.5% yield, we'll buy any number of them. So there's no reason to have them go over that number. And because you can just sell them if you have them, if you buy them over that number yourself, you can sell to the Fed and make a profit. So basically it kind of caps that as long as the market perceives that unlimited bid as credible. And so basically the market started to do it for it. So the first few years of that policy, the Fed had to do a tremendous amount of buying. And then once they proved that they're literally going to stick to it, the market just kind of did it for them. We see that happening in Japan as well, where Japan currently has yield curve control in place. They have an unlimited bid for 10-year JGBs. at what is it, 0.25%, and the market kind of does it a lot of that for them, right? So it's not like the market's not really fighting them on that, and that's even when you have those really hardcore controls in place, they're still partially relying on the market to look at what they're saying they're going to do and then kind of just front run them.
Yeah, and now we also have Russia in play, right? I read somewhere that Russia also tried to, during the financial crisis, they wanted to dump Fannie and Freddie stocks. I'm sure you've heard something about that. I mean, what's your take on this whole Russia thing now? Do you think they're going to be some kind of influence on the whole?
They can add that as a – so monetary, central banks around the world can now use that as cover, kind of like how they could use – the COVID recession, the pandemic recession, right, the lockdowns as cover for how, extreme actions. And so if at some reason they end up not being able to tighten as much as they hoped or telegraphed that they would, they can, blame uncertainty around the economy due to the war, right? So instead of just kind of, we were already, before this happened, like I said, the economy is already decelerating. If you look at the, say, purchasing managers indices, it looks like a sine wave, and it's already been rolling over for months now. We've already seen that in some of the more, sensitive stocks out there. Bitcoin tends to follow the PMIs pretty closely. It likes these risk on peers. It doesn't like the risk off peers, whether or not it makes sense, just kind of how it's aligned so far as a pretty young volatile asset. It's already kind of been signaling that way for a while. And it'd be really awkward if you just have like a recession or have a slowdown and there's no real reason for it. But now they can say, well, there's all these crazy macro things happening, and so we have to be more cautious and more dovish. On the other side of the equation, I mean, if you have an extreme scenario, that could, the what's happening in Europe can be more inflationary. If you had Russia shut off its energy exports to Europe, that's an outright catastrophe, because they rely
on oil prices going up.
Yeah, oil prices skyrocketing. Germany gets it's not only natural gas, they get natural gas, oil, and coal from Russia. And it's a really big percentage of all of them for Germany and other countries too. And that's why today some of those were against cutting Russia off the SWIFT system, because it's a lot harder to cut Russia off the SWIFT system than like Iran or North Korea, because in addition to being one of the largest military powers, they're one of the biggest energy exporters and just commodity exporters, even things like nickel, which you need for electric vehicles, so they're a big exporter of a lot of commodities.
Can they really do that? Like, ban them from the Swiss system?
Yeah,
like that.
They can. It's just my expectations, they probably wouldn't, because of the Europe situation where they need those commodities.
Because of the implication.
But they have the capacity to do it. It's just whether or not they can withstand the consequences, which is that Europe's lights go out, essentially. Or Russia and Europe just start using alternative systems. So you end up, banning Iran from SWIFT, Russia from SWIFT, and then still trading with Russia. So you kind of symbolically do it and make it harder for them. And they kind of did that a little bit. I mean, they blocked a bunch of Russian banks from interfacing with SWIFT. But they didn't do the nuclear option of completely severing the country from SWIFT. They added a lot of frictions around things that aren't related to energy, because that's the part they couldn't take the pain for.
Yeah, and talking about alternative systems, right? There was some rumors going around and some laws in the making in Russia around Bitcoin. I mean, how serious is that, and what do you expect of it?
Well, just like other countries, we've seen Russia do some flip-flopping, and people often think of governments as monolithic. But in everything other than the most extreme dictatorship, like maybe North Korea or something, like there's always these different subgroups. And so there's parts of Russia's government that is, like the KGB type stuff, like whatever they call themselves today, the more like the security research people, they don't particularly like Bitcoin because it allows their opponents to more freely transact and, store money outside of the banking system. So they want to go after that. On the other hand, there are people within Russia that realize that they can use it to go around other issues, and they realize that they're one of the better jurisdictions for mining. And so it's kind of an anti-sanction tool. It's money for enemies. I think you know, they're some of the smarter factions in there get it, and it is one of the tools they can use in the event that they do get cut off from SWIFT or they otherwise have to go around financial blockages. It's not the only option, but it's certainly one of the options is there, and it just works already.
Do you see a day that Bitcoin is going to, or that energy is going to be priced in Bitcoin?
If it gets big enough, yeah. I mean, right now it's like two, it's under $1 trillion market cap. It's rather volatile for that purpose. But if you add another zero to Bitcoin's market, it keeps doing kind of the same trend it's been doing for years, and it continues to get larger and eventually the volatility settles down to some extent. That is a network they can use. In the meantime, we've seen that, you can use Bitcoin without even having much exposure to the underlying asset. You can use the network itself briefly, and you can pair it with stable coins. You can do all sorts of things with it. And so I think they can explore it for that purpose. On the long enough timeline, if Bitcoin continues to be successful, yeah, I think they could price energy in it.
You're saying a lot of things here, like if instead of when.
I think overall it's best not to think, a lot of Bitcoiners like to think of in terms of inevitability, and I can see why, because obviously the technology is so strong and the math is so strong and the trend is so strong. But I don't like basically the idea of complacency, right? So yeah. It's like, I don't have 100% conviction in anything, whether it's dollars, gold, Bitcoin, whatever the case may be. It's just that some things
Roku.
Are...
Roku is the war.
Yeah, Roku is the war.
Roku is the warhead, apparently.
It's that is 100% sure.
Yeah.
So you definitely, so you don't have 100% certainty that we can't take you away from Pedro?
Nothing's 100%.
You like the zoom in feature right there?
That's how we create drama, right? You start talking and then you really ask a serious question.
What really, that's a good question. Like, what really orange pilled you? Like, was it like the investment, like part of Bitcoin, or was it like the technical background you had?
A little bit of both. So it's one of those things, like it's often said that you have to kind of run into Bitcoin a couple times to really get it. So
did you shitcoin?
No, not really. No, I've explored the others about how they work. Right. So because I like to learn, like I like to say, open a MetaMask and go try a DeFi out just to see what the interface is like. So I do it for research purposes, but not with any sort of, not like a, I don't trade with it. I don't do anything really other than that. The way I got orange pilled was basically I encountered it a number of times, and each time I thought it was neat, but I didn't know how to price it. And I didn't know if it would catch on. I didn't know if it'd be banned. And my biggest kind of question all along was, kind of the classic FUD. I think it's a reasonable question at first, which is, okay, if you can just make Bitcoin, why can't you just make another Bitcoin? And there's all these other cryptos, and what makes Bitcoin special? So that was kind of like my long-term thing that made me kind of skeptical. But even though I liked it, I thought it was neat. And eventually just kind of sitting down and seeing the network effects of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then especially seeing the Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash fork get settled by the market, I was like, okay, so this is, I was seeing the Bitcoin only industry develop separate from the crypto industry.
So this was around 2016, 17?
Yeah, I started covering it seriously in 2017. That's when I started really digging into it. I got the basic idea before then. Like, I was aware of it and I thought it was neat, but I just didn't, it wasn't on my radar to really cover. And once it, 2017 really kind of caught my eye, and then it had the blow off top, and I was like, it's too euphoric. But then as it kind of grinded through that bear market, that's when I got bullish. Mm-hmm. I said, okay, I kind of looked back at the long-term history. I looked at the log charts rather than the linear charts. I looked at network effect analysis on it. I kind of dug into the whole security model more closely, and basically that's what shifted me bullish on the asset. Spending time on it, essentially.
It wasn't John McAfee's $1 million call in 2021 that got you to buy Bitcoin.
No, probably if anything, those kind of calls are what, I sympathize with the people that don't get Bitcoin, because they go online and they see people like, calling for $1 million by X date.
Yes.
And they're kind of like,
That's Sean.
So, but
if you don't do that, you're bearish. So you. Gotta figure out which way.
Yeah, Lynn, when do you think it's going to hit $1 million USD?
So I think a long time, but I think it's not unreasonable that it gets there, right? So I think, you know, looking at there's like all those logarithmic trends you can do, right? So I think 2030 maybe, right?
But the date. I want the date.
I'm joking.
April 3rd, 2032.
At
7:54 p.m. Eastern time.
Nice. Okay, write that down.
That's a little too specific. It's a little.
Got that under the rug.
All right.
Noted.
Recorded forever.
It's on the internet now.
Yeah.
Is that EST time?
Yeah. What?
Max, eat your heart up.
Yeah. Okay. American exceptionalism.
The 4-year cycle still intact.
So I think that the. I think not necessarily. So I think over time, because the halving gets it's a smaller, you know, percentage of the coins each time. That I think basically, I'm looking at kind of the HODL waves as more of the cycle indicator, where, you know, when Bitcoin price action is not great, you have all like the long term hardcore people dollar cost averaging into it and accumulating it and kind of, you know, taking that liquidity out of the market, and that eventually causes like a price floor, and causes a liquidity shock. And especially because so far Bitcoin's kind of followed the U.S. purchase managed indices cycle. It's kind of the economic acceleration, decelerating, like, you know, these kind of 3-year cycles. And so it's kind of followed with that roughly. And so I think the combination of the HODL wave and just these ebbs and flows of the economy and liquidity are probably what's going to drive it. In the past, that the halving did basically act as a catalyst because you just suddenly had a supply shock. And I think that helps. I think it's still like a tailwind when it happens, at least like, you know, the over the year after it happens. But in theory, that effect should diminish over time. And it's more about the fact that it's just a very, very scarce asset and that there's a large group of people that keep dollar cost averaging into it. And that, you know, looking at, say, the percentage of coins that haven't moved in 1 year, you see this kind of sine wave. And I think that kind of that's what kind of drives the cycle a lot going forward.
There's this other scenario, right, where people talk about, yeah, there's this idea, the Bitcoin idea and the Bitcoin story, you know, that like fiat is broken and they're debasing fiat at a massive rate. Right now, there's like a group of maybe 10 or 12% of the population that feels that way about it, but that number is growing. And once it hits this number of whatever it is, maybe 40%, then suddenly, and then we're just going to see like this massive sudden bank run, and we're going to see like a Weimar style hyper Bitcoinization event, and we just go up.
That's like that. It's like that stock to FOMO model, where just instead of kind of like going out, it kind of like curves up and then just goes like straight up.
Yeah.
So, because I analyzed the long term debt cycle. And that's been one of my big research subjects. Is essentially, you know, there's the short-term business cycle, and then there's that long-term kind of debt accumulation cycle, which mostly gets quote-unquote solved with currency devaluation. There's lots of crazy things that can happen around those periods, right? So when you're stuck with one currency where, you know, the number of units is going up by, let's call it 10% a year in a good year, and the interest rates are below the inflation rate, and you have another currency that's like, you know, supply capped, algorithmic, you know, is only 10% of it even like still to be created. You know, that kind of speaks for itself over the long run. So it's like they say, like the way to, you know, when you run a marathon, the goal is just to finish. You don't have to, it's not about being as fast as you can, unless you're obviously like a pro, just finish the marathon, just keep going. Doesn't matter how long it takes. And so all Bitcoin has to do is just keep going. And it's just got the tailwinds of being the super hard asset up against currencies that routinely just go to zero, some faster than others. You know, they lose 90% of their, you know, value over time.
Yeah,
and if you do get to a point where, you know, inflation's obviously a serious problem, and there's just too much debt in the system, and if the Fed, for example, fails to raise interest rates, and it basically has to give up because
trust
it starts
is
causing,
gone.
Yeah, then you can get these outlier events where, you know, the trend just breaks and just things change overnight. So I don't rule that out. I mean, you have that happen in emerging market currencies all the time. And the only question is can this get bad enough that it happens to develop market currencies? And it's certainly possible.
Yeah, I think, I mean, when we talk about inflation, right, there is you know, inflation in the 70s, inflation in the 40s. And, you know, I think around a year ago or so, you wrote an article that was titled, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was titled The Fraying of the U.S. Dollar. And I know you've explained this a lot of times, but I think it'd be great for, you know, just to hear it again. Like, what's kind of the difference between inflation now versus inflation in the 70s or in the 40s? Is it just that, we have all this debt, there's this world debt, there's the U.S. debt, or is there other things as well that are involved in the difference in inflation now?
So the main answer to that is that, you know, in modern central banking system and the commercial banking system, there are really two main ways to make money, broad money. And that's either banks lend it into existence, right? So, and what I mean by broad money is that if a central bank just increases its balance sheet, that goes into the banking system and into the financial system, but it doesn't actually increase the amount of money circulating between, you know, people and companies, right? So it doesn't actually increase their buying power. But there are mainly two main ways to get money out to the broad money supply. One is that commercial banks multiply it by lending it. And two is that the government just runs these massive deficits and has the central bank buy a lot of their bonds. And so that's what gets the money out. You know, it's what makes 2020 different than 2008, because 2008, you know, you didn't have these massive fiscal stimulus. You had smaller ones. And so back in the 70s, you mostly had the first type. You mostly had commercial bank lending. And the reason was, around the world, you kind of had a demographics boom. So the baby boom generation in various countries was kind of coming to age and buying homes. And so you had a big home construction boom. And that's a key part of bank lending and inflation. And at the same time, you had a commodity constraint, because the U.S., for example, you know, you had like 100 years of like constantly increasing U.S. oil production, and it peaked in 1970. And then it rolled over like a big bell curve and just started going down. And so we had to start importing oil from the Middle East. And then you had geopolitical issues there. They cut us off from that, and it caused this inflation issue. So the combination of a big increase in the money supply, plus there were fiscal deficits related to both the war and domestic policies, and demographics, and then real world supply constraints. Now, what made that different was that debt was so low. So debt as a percentage of GDP, both government debt and private debt, was pretty low relative to GDP. And so the Fed was able to raise interest rates super high to basically put the economy into a recession and give positive real rates structurally. Mm-hmm. and stabilize confidence in the currency, because there's a big opportunity cost for, say, holding gold. They hold zero. If you can instead put money in a bank or hold government bonds and get paid a rate that is several points higher than the inflation rate. So they were just able to stabilize that. If you go back to the 40s, that inflation was not from bank lending for the most part. Banks were not lending much. That was obviously a very hard time to be lending and making long-term plans about the future. Instead, you had various governments running these massive deficits and having their central bank monetize it. And so inflation in that system tends to be more on and off. Like, you just kind of get this huge burst in inflation, and then combination of price controls or like changing, you know, what's happening with the war, you can have inflation go away quickly and then come back again. And so basically it just burns away the debt, because you're holding – debt is so high in that environment that you're holding rates low even though you have high inflation. And so the reason I use the 40s more so than the 70s is because, you know, the inflation we're seeing now is not from bank lending. So you don't see a lot of bank lending in Japan. You don't see a lot of bank lending in Europe. You don't see a lot of bank lending in the United States. There's no demographics boom, really. And instead, what we're mostly seeing is those large fiscal deficits that are being monetized. And so that's where the growth in the money supply is coming. And then it is running into supply constraints, real-world constraints, similar to the 70s and the 40s, which is essentially, you know, over the 2010s, we had the rise of shale oil, and we had a slowdown of China. So we generally had commodity oversupply. And so we could kind of get away with a decent amount of money printing and not run into inflation. Whereas in the 2020s, because we have tighter commodity markets, especially energy markets, combined with a higher than normal amount of money creation, similar to the 70s or the 40s, mostly using the mechanism of the 40s, we're more prone to inflation overall. And so that's and like the 40s, because debt is so high, they have trouble raising interest rates. And so that's why you get the biggest, you know, the deepest negative real yields since, you know, the 1940s or the early 50s.
I have to say that I'm actually taking notes for things to Google. And so thanks for that, all that alpha. I really appreciate it.
I've got
a question, Yella.
I've got two questions out of that.
Go.
Yeah, all right, so number one, what if we bought you an Aston Martin? Still no? Well,
I'll pass on. These days, they are appreciating assets, though, apparently. They used to be depreciating assets. Now they appreciate.
All right, number two.
A new Aston Martin?
Used.
No.
Yeah, we'll just get a used one.
We need the sets.
The new ones look the same as the old ones. It's good. She won't notice.
Yeah,
she'll never know. The other one is I want to do a little thought experiment. So you mentioned the long-term debt cycle, which has been made popular by Ray Dalio, or popularly a little more widely known. For anybody who's not aware of what the long-term debt cycle is, you're talking about basically an 80-year-ish time frame where structural debt in the global economy builds up to a point where you either need to ease it with shit ton of inflation, or you reset the state and chain of custody and rules of the system with war.
A beautiful deleveraging.
Now, the thought experiment I want to run is, let's say we get to a point in the future where Bitcoin is at the base layer of money. Do we get debt cycles or long-term debt cycles anymore at that point?
Well, you definitely got fewer of, you didn't really get the same type of cycle back in, say, the free banking era, right? So when you had gold as base layer, and it's partly because no one wants, you know, fewer people want to take out debt. And if that debt gets stronger over time, so there's more incentive to take out debt when the value of that debt decreases over time. And so in general, you should have a much less credit-driven economy when you have kind of a harder asset underneath. Now, you'll still have credit. I mean, you can make credit anytime you just say, I'll pay you next week, right? So anytime two people just make an agreement like that, you've essentially made credit. And then, you know, credit on a bigger scale is just the formalization of that. But in general, you'd expect much less of that when you don't have such a financialized economy and you don't have basically all these currencies devaluing at kind of this ongoing rate that's like, you know, 2% in a good year, 3% on average, and like, you know, depending on where you live, it's much higher. And then so you should have just, you know, if you, the cycles weren't as clean when you go back further than that. Now you still got currency devaluation. So for example, you know, the idea of debt jubilees or kind of generational resets, that goes back thousands of years, right? So you know, the quote I like to use is from you know, Lessons of History. It refers to 2600 years ago in ancient Greece, and they did this kind of like currency reset because there's too much debt in the system. And so on some aspect of it, it's just human nature, regardless of how hard you make money. But it takes different forms depending on what that underlying currency is. You know, it's more just outright defaults and things like that when you have, you know, that kind of system. I think a good analogy is that, you know, if you leave your computer on for a long period of time due to memory leaks and other things like that, it starts running worse and worse and worse until it starts to crash. And you just reset the computer sometimes and kind of like refresh it. And because, you know, we're like animals that have like linear minds and money is like exponential. After a couple of generations, we kind of get into this trap where like just kind of everything's like gummed up and there's so much entropy in the system that you either have revolution or war or something kind of resets it and creates new institutions. So I think on some aspect that's it's almost inevitable, but you know, it can take much different forms and people can be more protected by it, you know, when you have a better underlying money.
So you're saying it's more of a feature of the human condition than it is of fractional reserve banking.
Yeah, but we've financialized it to such a degree that we've kind of made like an inevitability out of it. Whereas before it was more irregular, and now you can kind of map it because you have, you know, essentially what makes a long-term debt cycle different than a short-term debt cycle. So in a short-term debt cycle, you have a recession, you cut interest rates, you do QE, You short circuit the deleveraging and start building up leverage again. And over time, you get, say, higher and higher debt as a percentage of GDP in each cycle. So higher highs and higher lows, and you get lower interest rates, lower lows and lower highs. And it makes a long-term debt cycle different is that that's when you hit zero, right? So you get down to zero interest rates or even slightly negative interest rates. And it's really hard to keep building up debt. And so that's when they turn to those more inflationary devaluation components, or they try to hold it there and then populism grows and you could get a revolution, or you could get some sort of just big change of the social contract in that society. There's more extreme versions, and then there's more kind of like moderate versions of how they get out of it. But it's never pretty.
Talking about war, it's nearly 24 hours, I think, that Russia invaded Ukraine. And I would love to hear what your thoughts around the current news and around, of course, the energy play, power play, the geopolitical stuff, and of course, down the line, Bitcoin.
Yes. So yeah, we're almost 24 hours into it, and you know, there are geopolitical experts that can go into way more detail than I can. I can only focus on the stuff that I can quantify or the things that I put research into. And so, for example, you know, after World War II, the United States was like 40% of global GDP. You know, most countries were devastated. There was like this one superpower left. And so over time, as the rest of the world's recovered, you know, the U.S. share of global GDP has gone down and down and down. And due to the way we've structured the petrodollar system, we've had to run these big trade deficits in order to maintain the system. And so you start to get a more multipolar world. There's other very large powers out there, China, Russia, Europe as a whole, for example. You have these kind of multipolar world. And so this kind of period of stability we've had, I think we're shifting away from it. And generally you have, you know, kind of a hyperpower starts to overextend, you know, becomes a country, becomes an empire, and then it naturally just overextends. And then it has trouble maintaining its overextended state, and it starts losing wars, and then other powers grow. And we're kind of unfortunately seeing that, where we've overextended, we've done these unsuccessful, unproductive wars, you know, pretty much only bads come from it. And other countries have gotten stronger, and they sense that weakness. And they know that in terms of both capability and interest, America's not going to go to war in most circumstances with any sort of, at least with any sort of large force that can fight back, especially that has nuclear power. And so we're in a kind of a different world now. So, you know, whether it's China and Taiwan or Russia and Ukraine, we have these more multipolar actions taking place. And so I think we spent decades in this kind of disinflationary cycle where companies were incentivized to make supply chains as efficient as possible at the cost of resiliency, right? So you just kind of don't hold inventory, you know, globalize everything, you know, offshore everything, be super efficient, super lean, and don't worry about resiliency, because what's going to go wrong? And I think that we're getting the bill for that, which is when geopolitics change, things are a lot messier now. And so Russia's done this aggression against Ukraine. We're going to see where that goes. The problem is that Europe is entirely reliant on Russia for its energy needs for multiple reasons. You know, they've shut down part of their nuclear, but even without that, just, you know, as one of the largest energy producers, Russia, you know, contributes to that. It's something like 40% of European gas, and it's a really big chunk of their coal and their oil. And so, you know, it's also, if you look at, you know, decades ago, the United States was the largest trading partner with vast majority of countries. And now China is the largest trading partner in most countries, including Germany, for example. And so the U.S. has less sway than it used to. And we've also kind of, you know, undermined ourselves morally, right? So we can't, you know, it's harder for us to say, hey, respect that country's sovereignty, because we don't respect country sovereignty very often. And so I think just over time, this current kind of framework we've had for decades and decades and decades is fraying under its own weight and just kind of classic kind of empire status. And so I think we're entering a world of more scarcity and more multipolar, which is on average probably a more inflationary world.
Yeah, one of the most silly narratives I heard from the EU officials was like that it's like we haven't seen a war like this. Like the last time we saw a war like this was like World War II, and they just like forget totally about like Serbia. Like you guys did like a war there too, was Europe. Like the level of hypocrisy, it's, I don't know, it's triggering me.
Guys?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe jumping on the back of that, like, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on, and Bitcoiners like to say, you know, you're going to move or money is going to move where it's treated best and stuff. Like, it's maybe a little bit of a personal question, but are you like looking at maybe at some point, you know, moving somewhere else or looking into places like that? And what are the kind of areas you would look towards?
So a challenge for Americans is that if you go somewhere else, you still get taxed. It's like a global tax system. And even if you say renounce citizenship, you know, you have a big exit tax essentially. So that kind of arbitrage, that kind of geographic arbitrage is harder for Americans than many other citizens of other countries. So yeah, I'm not, but like, for example, I travel to Egypt sometimes because I have family there. And so we kind of actually go back and forth. That has its own problems, obviously. I think it makes sense for a lot of people to have kind of second places. It's particularly challenging for Americans just because how we set up our system. Right. And so, the United States has a lot of problems, but it's still, it might not be the single best place, but in terms of, the number of options you have in the United States, right? So the broad geography, the broad industries, it's still one of the more interesting places, compared to a lot of other developed areas. But it has its shortcomings, and there are kind of these up and coming countries, especially for people that are from other countries and can move more easily. There are places in Latin America that are interesting. There are all sorts of places around the world that someone can find a little niche in that could be more favorable than where they started.
Kind of going back over the last 2 years, right? We've had COVID, which we haven't talked about today, which has actually been kind of nice thinking about something else, even though it's been war, which is weird to think about. But
COVID is nice. You hear it here first.
Yeah. Just, I kind of been thinking about this, and I wanted to ask you this. Like, say you were just like out in the middle of nowhere for the last 2 years, you specifically, Lynn, and all you had access to was, like, you had access to no news, no TV, but you had access to just looking at the markets, how they're moving. You could see if the Fed's balance sheet was expanding. You could see, if stocks were going up, if they were going down, and all those things. If you had access to that information, but you couldn't see the news and you didn't know what was going on, what would be your guess of what happened over the last 2 years or so?
Probably some type of war. Maybe not involving the U.S. because it's one of the better stock markets. But seeing all these kind of – seeing the straight line up in central bank balance sheets like across the world, and then seeing inflation come later. Yeah. And the stocks kind of have that crack up boom aspect where they went up. But, if you compare it to the money supply going up, it's, kind of just kept up with it. It does look like war. And I've described – that's also why I compared it to the 40s. And it's funny because I've been making that comparison for like 2 years now, comparing it to the 40s. And I kept calling it wartime finance. And I'm saying you don't really need a war to have wartime finance, right? So in this case, having a highly levered system that is not built to withstand shocks, be hit by a shock, is essentially a wartime situation, right? So you have governments have their, it's kind of an existential issue for them to deal with. And so we've had essentially wartime finance. And then now we're seeing the risk is that you can actually get into actual war, right? So you can have, we've had a 20-year war in the Middle East that's now essentially over for the US. With kind of a cherry on top for how poorly it ended, the pullout. And then you add, obviously, what happened, Russia and Ukraine in the past 24 hours. And then you have, an ongoing kind of similar issue with China and Taiwan. We don't know how that's going to turn out. I have my suspicions how it's going to turn now, but we don't know. We don't know the future.
What are your suspicions? And so, let me dig in.
I would not particularly want to be a resident of Taiwan long term, right? So I don't think that's, you know, I think
the odds are against them. Yeah.
I think the longer it goes, the more it's in China's favor. You know, the more they can kind of get away with doing it and being able to withstand the consequences. I think part of what happens with Russia here will, you know, maybe dictate some of the timeline that China goes with. There are a bunch of factors that can change it, but, you know, I'm not particularly optimistic. But essentially, you know, we already had kind of wartime finance, and now we're actually risking and already experiencing in some places actual war. And so, yeah, if I didn't know there's a pandemic and I was just on an island and looking at the numbers, I would assume some type of war, and primarily outside of the U.S. because the stock market probably would have been worse in the U.S. if any sort of war involved, you know, U.S. homeland.
All it's right. Interesting, and it's interesting to think about the China and Russia, because it seems like they're both looking to do similar things. And you just sometimes you think about, you know, are they looking to make somewhat of an alliance between each other, because you know they're both risking as China goes after Taiwan, as Russia goes after Ukraine, they're both risking, you know, losing the SWIFT privileges. And so it would be interesting to see what, you know, if they have something in their back pockets with each other.
They also complement each other's economies well, because China, their biggest weakness is they need commodities, and they produce a lot of high tech stuff. They produce a lot of, you know, just manufactured stuff in general. Whereas Russia, you know, they're high tech in some areas. They're high tech for aerospace. They're, you know, they have good programmers, but it's generally not known as a tech powerhouse. It's mostly commodities and things like that. And so they actually complement each other very well in terms of the amount of trade they can do between each other and how much they can shore up their weaknesses. So Russia can buy Chinese electronics, Chinese goods, and sell commodities to China to you know, fund that. And so in addition, as they kind of, you know, put force in different areas of the world, they have to kind of assume that they're not going to get attacked from the back, right? So the fact that they share a border, they have to kind of trust that the other one's not going to take advantage of that side of the country being maybe less defended. And from Russia's perspective, I mean, they've been invaded multiple times from the east. So that's where their focus generally has been, is what's going on in the east. At least, you know, World War II was kind of an exception, but primarily, especially where Moscow is located, they're more eastern focused. Whereas obviously China's more focused on the South China Sea, and so where they connect, if they can just assume that that's not going to be a contentious border, it allows them to kind of concentrate their forces in the areas that concern them more. So yeah, to the extent that they can hold together a loose alliance, that's really powerful for them for you know, kind of against American and European interests.
Okay. No,
I've maybe got one more. I mean, if you're looking at Bitcoin Twitter, they'll point you to like all kinds of stuff and they uncover everything. And in the last couple of weeks, there's been a lot of talk about like the World Economic Forum. And you've seen now that in Canada, they're busy rolling out, I think it was the Association of Canadian Bankers or something. They presented, they're rolling out this digital ID or federal ID, and Europe is talking about a digital ID, and apparently Australia has already implemented it. So there seems to be like this globalist movement from the World Economic Forum. Any thoughts on that, or how have you been viewing that? Is there any merit to it, or?
I mean, if they're doing a really good job of making this look like Bond villains, right? I mean, it's you know, like, what is it?
Spectre.
Yeah, pretty much. Like that's kind of how they look, right? So it's got the whole Dr. Evil vibe to it. Like the, you know, you'll own nothing and you'll be happy. Like if you had the most tone deaf like mottos, like that's high on the list of, and like.
And they penetrated all the cabinets.
We penetrated all the cabinets. Yeah. Literally like twirling their mustache, and like you have like some of those events where like elites like unsarcastically refer to themselves as elites, kind of like that sort of vibe. There's also been issues in like. The way I would phrase it essentially is you have this environment where it's clear that resources are getting more scarce, right? So and now that the shale kind of boom is kind of behind us, oil's kind of back to being a scarce commodity again to some extent. It's not something that we know we'll have enough of 5 years from now, right? So we'll see. And then when you look at, say, if you kind of imagine how many electric vehicles like the Tesla wants to have on the road and things like that, you know, basically then you have copper and nickel being short. We don't have copper and nickel for that. And so you have this kind of environment where I think the whole thing of Davos is like, for example, people fly together in private jet. They go in private jets, then talk about how we got to like consume less energy per capita. And you had even like European proposals. I think it was last year where like you were talking about increasing taxes on commercial flight to rein in like, you know, the pollution, but they were going to exclude private jets. And it's like, are you trying to like look like, is that really what you're doing? That's where you're going with? You're just making it that obvious?
You just don't care.
So
you don't care about the optics.
When you penetrate half the cabinets and you make the rules, then no one can say anything.
And so it really ever since the whole kind of post World War II order, we've had these central organizations. So the IMF, the World Bank, the Bank of International Settlements. I mean, they all kind of, some of them date to Bretton Woods, some of them date earlier than that, some of them date after that. But you have these kind of global organizations. So basically, you do have central banks, bankers talking to each other. You do have governments talking to each other, and there are these kind of alliances. And so, you know, I don't have the most conspiratorial views on things. Because in some ways that assumes too much competence, right? So the whole kind of issue with the conspiracies is that you have, on one hand, you know, you kind of assume that a lot of government actors are not very smart. On the other hand, it's like they're almost so smart and they're scheming and they're kind of doing all this. And it's like, which one is it, right? And I tend to think it's a mix of both. You have these alliances that happen, and they generally communicate. They have certain trends they want to do. And then you also have incompetence built in there as well. And so I do think that there are forces like that that have those kind of long-term agendas. And there's even like the long-term debt cycle stuff I talk about, like the Fed can't say out loud, hey, we want to hold rates below the inflation rate to inflate some of the debt away. So that's why we're doing this, right? They can't really say that. But if you look at, for example, the IMF published a paper called The Liquidation of Government Debt, where they talked about holding rates below the inflation rate, like the 1940s, they kind of cataloged the whole 1940s, and they said, it looks like we're going to have to do it again. Mm-hmm. And of course, the paper said, you know, this is not necessarily endorsed by the IMF, but, you know, it's out there. It's just, yeah. It was published by them. And before then, a similar paper is published by the National Bureau of Economists. And so, you know, it's understood that these things are kind of out there. And it's kind of these almost like conspiracies that are just out there. Just, you know, just if you Google them, they're just there.
All right. So, Lynn, we're coming up on our hour, and I know you've been very generous with your time with us. I want to make sure you have some time, if you wanted to ask anybody here any questions.
I would say, what makes you all the most bullish on Bitcoin, and where do you get your conviction from?
I'd like to
memes.
Memes, yeah.
The memes.
Totally. 100%.
I think the pleb right next to me that is staying around, still researching stuff, still making stuff, like that kind of solidarity works for me.
One thing that makes 2020 so different than those other periods we discussed is the speed of information. Yeah. And memes are among the fastest way to spread information because, you know, they seem like a joke to people, but the whole point of a meme, they say a picture is worth 1,000 words. And it's like, okay, we'll take a picture. And then because people use kind of similar meme templates or you know, they make new ones from movies we've all seen. And so an image or a short video has a certain amount of information already embedded in it. And then you just overlay the message you're trying to say with that. And so you can kind of convey a tremendous amount of information in a very short period of time and have it be funny enough that people want to share it and laugh at it. And so imagine in the 40s, if the Fed was holding rates at zero and inflation was 19%, and there are people on Twitter like memeing about it, right? So it's like it's much harder to do, but you had to like, back then you had to like get the Wall Street Journal and like read about it like a month later.
Yeah.
And be like, so it's hard to keep up with what's happening. And so when information moves more slowly,
Trudeau just found out this year.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly, yeah. Before you'd find out in hindsight, oh, that happened. Whereas Whereas now it's like in real time, and you're being, you know, the central bankers are being memed while they're doing their things. And so that's what makes this environment much more unpredictable, and just kind of like, you know, policymakers might have these plans of what they want to do, and they might not have factored in the memes.
I have an outside question.
Oh, okay.
I have an outside question from Preston Pish for Lynn. It's more of a request. The exact wording was, I think, could you please stop making us all look so stupid?
Not gonna happen.
And I'd like to echo that with memes. I really hate that you do like one meme every couple of months, and it's better than anything I put out. It's a pain.
How do those memes come about, Lynn? Like, tell us about it.
I think they just kind of, well, one is by not doing many. We're not doing a ton, at least. Like I do a little more lately, but basically by not doing a ton, it's just like when it kind of builds up over a week, and I finally, it kind of clicks, and then I'm like, okay, let me put that one out there. And
quality, not quantity.
Yeah. And also I don't do video ones. So that's my weakness.
So you don't go and cut out Preston Fish's head and stick it on like, something else.
You know, I haven't taken the time to do all the more complex ones. I try to do a very kind of the simple, funny ones.
Have an idea that's a little bit more complex, you can always hit us up.
Oh, please. Something for you. Yes.
Sure. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. The most important quest of the night is RDs.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God.
Oh, no. Is he on mute still? Then.
Most important question. If the meme factory did exist, and we all know it doesn't, which one of us would you like? Which one of us would you retweet? Which one of us would you mute?
It's hard.
Another smile. Good one.
I said, I don't know if I can retweet any Greg stuff, because it's all like...
terrible.
You know. What is it like? Is it like, retweet, and meet? Is those the three?
Mute.
Okay, so let's see. I guess I'd have to. I don't know if I can like or retweet Greg. So if I have to mute him, unfortunately.
Yeah.
If I had to put him in one of those categories.
It's career suicide for you.
I might have to just mute everyone. That's the thing.
We're all muted. Brand, I love it.
Brand purity. You're like, and then follow you with my alt account, essentially. Yeah. So I don't miss out.
You heard it here. Lynn has a sock puppet.
Sock puppet account.
Yeah.
Quarantango is their sock puppet account.
All right. And
Jaybird.
Sean, you've got an invite too, right?
Yes, Lynn. So, we, as the Meme Factory, we have a party coming up, and it's coming up in 2024 for the halving, for the Bitcoin 2024 halving. And you're invited. Come along, bring your family and friends, and it's going to be a blast. You know, we have a lot of people coming, and we definitely would love to have you there.
Looking forward to it. Hopefully World War III doesn't happen first.
Yeah, exactly. It'll be block height 840 if you want to know what time. So,
nice.
840,000.
All right. And Lynn, before we roll this out, where can people find you if they want to see more of your material?
If you want to read the long stuff, it's lynnalden.com. And if you want the memes, it's at lynnaldencontact on Twitter.
All right. And that's also going to be in the show notes. Check it out. Thanks for coming by, everybody.
Thanks so much. It was cool.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Lynn.
Thanks for being here.
Have a good night.